The Court's Impact on the Environment, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy was seen as a defender of the environment on the Supreme Court. President Trump's pick to replace him, Brett Kavanaugh, would likely take the court in a different direction.
We're much more likely to see a Justice Kavanaugh follow in the footsteps of Antonin Scalia, who was pretty hostile to environmental regulation.
Also, a closer look at a government task force that investigates naturalized U.S. citizens looking for evidence of fraud or other wrongdoing in their applications. Some fear the program could be abused. Plus, a newcomer to Mexico City learns a hard lesson.
What do you mean a quesadilla doesn't always come with cheese?
Those stories and much more coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. The ball is now in Congress's court. Last night, President Trump unveiled his nominee to fill Justice Anthony Kennedy's seat on the Supreme Court. He is Brett Kavanaugh, currently a federal appeals judge in Washington, and he's already started making the rounds on Capitol Hill ahead of what is certain to be a politically charged confirmation process. The battle over Kavanaugh's nomination will likely hinge on whether or not he would uphold Roe v. Wade. And we'll get to his record on abortion in just a few minutes, but first we're going to look at Kavanaugh's record on another issue that will have impacts beyond our national borders. Climate change.
On more than one occasion, Judge Kavanaugh has acknowledged that climate change is real and is a pressing public policy problem.
Ann Carlson is the Shapiro Professor of Environmental Law at UCLA.
But at the same time, he has made very clear that the Environmental Protection Agency should not have broad power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act.
Kavanaugh served as a clerk for Justice Kennedy, but Carlson says that if confirmed, the new justice could take the court in a different direction on environmental cases.
I think it's safe to say, based on Judge Kavanaugh's record on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, that he would not follow Justice Kennedy's legacy of being the swing vote and often in the majority on cases that are protective of the environment. I think we're much more likely to see a Justice Kavanaugh, assuming that he's confirmed, follow in the footsteps of Antonin Scalia, who was pretty hostile to environmental regulation.
What can you tell us about Judge Kavanaugh's record on cases related to climate change?
I think it's safe to say that had he been on the Supreme Court when a major case came up to the Supreme Court in 2007 about whether the Clean Air Act covers greenhouse gases, he would have ruled with the conservatives and said, no, it does not. Since that time, because he's bound by U.S. Supreme Court precedent, he has used his authority to say that the Clean Air Act can only be used very narrowly to regulate greenhouse gases in a very modest way.
Does that mean that the Clean Air Act is at stake? Could there be a case that comes to the court that could change the current situation we have?
It is possible that a new majority on the Supreme Court that includes Judge Kavanaugh, assuming that he gets confirmed, could overrule Massachusetts versus EPA, which is the case that said that the Clean Air Act covers greenhouse gas emissions as pollutants and can be used to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles. I think that's not very likely. Generally speaking, the United States Supreme Court does not like to overturn itself, but I think what's more likely is that the court will follow what Judge Kavanaugh has done in his position on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and simply limit the Environmental Protection Agency's power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions in a way that really makes a difference to the climate.
So how could his views have an impact on some cases that might come before the court? I mean, I'm thinking of the Clean Power Plan, the Obama-era law to cut carbon emissions at power plants. That's been stuck in the lower courts for years. How could that play out if Judge Kavanaugh becomes part of the court?
Well, Judge Kavanaugh was actually part of the panel that heard oral arguments on the Clean Power Plan in 2016. And I think it's very likely that if the Clean Power Plan were to come before the United States Supreme Court, Judge Kavanaugh would vote to strike it down, and I suspect that he would have four other members of the court who would join him in doing so.
The U.S. is a big player in terms of emitting greenhouse gases. Are there any cases that could come up before the Supreme Court that would have a really global impact?
I think it's safe to say right now that the global impact that the United States is having is really because the Trump administration is rolling back the policies of the Obama administration. And so in the short term, what the president is doing is actually much more impactful. I think it's undermining the global consensus that we need to be aggressively reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But what the Supreme Court could do is really hamper the ability of a new president, say a new president is elected in 2020 who wants to use the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases. I think this configuration of the Supreme Court with a new, more conservative justice could very easily significantly limit the federal government's authority to do that.
Ann Carlson is co-director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
One case that's likely to come up during Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings is Garza versus Azar. It's a case from last year involving an undocumented teen seeking an abortion while in federal custody. Kavanaugh heard it as a judge on the D.C. Court of Appeals. Josh Gerstein is a reporter for Politico. Josh, can you give us some background on the teenage girl at the center of Garza versus Azar?
So she crossed the border from Latin America, apparently by herself, and was taken into custody, I believe, by the Border Patrol. And eventually, in accordance with the U.S. law, she was put into kind of a residential center, a home that the Department of Health and Human Services maintains. They have medical checks and so forth. And it was determined that she was pregnant. Controversy ensued over her request to have an abortion while she was in the custody of the U.S. government.
So a lower court sided with the teen and the ACLU, so the case went to the U.S. Circuit Court in D.C. What was Judge Kavanaugh's role in the case at that point?
So he was initially one of three judges who were assigned to hear the case on an emergency basis. I was there at the oral arguments, and Kavanaugh, it seemed to me, that he was very eager to find some kind of a compromise that would essentially make this case go away. Kavanaugh's notion was that if the Trump administration didn't want to be involved in what they said was facilitating an abortion, one way would be to simply release this girl into the custody of what they call a sponsor, which is basically a guardian or an adult to take her out of government custody. The girl had already gone through the process in Texas to get permission to get an abortion without parental approval. And Kavanaugh felt that the best thing was that option. And what happened at that point would be up to her.
Now, eventually, the case ended up at the Supreme Court. What was the final ruling?
Well, actually, it ended up at the Supreme Court at a point where she had already had the abortion. What ended up happening was while Kavanaugh said he was willing to give the government basically 10 days to find a sponsor, the ACLU and this girl took the issue to the broader bench of the D.C. Circuit, which essentially reversed the ruling that Kavanaugh and one of his colleagues had issued. And once that order was issued, the procedure was carried out the next morning before the Trump administration really got its act together to take the issue to the Supreme Court. So by the time the case reached the Supreme Court, and the issue really had become a question of whether the ACLU lawyers had been honest with the Justice Department. Justice Department attorneys complained that they had been misled and asked the Supreme Court to intervene and impose some kind of discipline. The justices elected not to do that. And also in so doing, they basically wiped out the D.C. Circuit decision.
In his role at the D.C. Circuit Court, Judge Kavanaugh was criticized on the left and the right for his decision and oral argument in Garza versus Azar. What were the concerns on each side?
Well, I think from the left, from the ACLU, they felt that he was unfairly delaying her choice. And with each week that a pregnancy went along, obviously it becomes more medically risky and potentially complicated to have the abortion. There were also some conservatives that were a little disappointed in Kavanaugh that he was looking for a compromise here and that he didn't really issue an opinion that was a clarion call on abortion rights and also on the rights of immigrants. There was another judge on the panel who issued an opinion that was even more strident that basically said that an immigrant or an immigrant teen under these circumstances didn't really have constitutional rights. And so she didn't have the right to an abortion. And Kavanaugh took an act of judicial restraint. This wasn't the right case to decide that, seemed to be Kavanaugh's view. And, you know, that really brought him some criticism from both sides.
How could this case affect Kavanaugh's Supreme Court bid?
Well, you're going to see some discussion of this case because there really aren't that many sort of toeholds here. to try to take a look at what Kavanaugh's views are on abortion. Judges don't really get that many cases related to abortion. And this is one that he had. He did talk in his opinion about his Democratic appointed colleagues trying to set up an immediate right to abortion on demand, which kind of sounds like language that someone who's anti-abortion might use. But you'll see a lot of senators, I think, trying to go through his ruling here, ask him about his decision, and try to figure out where he really is on this. His answer in the prior hearing doesn't really give you that much insight as to what he would do if he does make it onto the high court.
Josh Gerstein is a White House reporter for Politico. Thanks, Josh.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
President Trump's crackdown on immigration has put ICE in the spotlight. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency is tasked with tracking down undocumented immigrants and deporting them. And sometimes ICE agents act on tips from the public. There's even a tip line that people can call nationwide. And when they do, someone in northern Vermont might be the one who answers. The ICE call center outside Burlington, Vermont is housed in a brick office building just a few hundred yards from a Bed Bath & Beyond store. VT Digger reporter Elizabeth Hewitt went to take a look.
There's not a lot that makes clear that this is an ICE facility. It's a couple hundred yards away from a Bed Bath & Beyond, big parking facility outside. It's across the street from a bank. It is a pretty significant hub of ICE activity, at least in Vermont. The overall facility has a couple different branches, including this other law enforcement support center function, which has more than 100 employees. But it seems to be a pretty small operation, all told.
Did it open after Trump was elected, or has it been there a while?
It actually has been here since 2003. Currently, they take tips on more than 400 different offenses. It's sort of everything that is relevant to ICE enforcement. And this ranges from things like trade violations to human trafficking, human rights violations, and, of course, immigration offenses.
Since Trump was elected, he has instructed ICE to crack down more strongly on immigrants who've committed even very minor crimes. In your reporting, did you find any evidence of an increase in calls and cases prioritizing the deportation of illegal immigrants?
We do know that there was a 27% increase in the number of calls that came in between 2016 and 2017, pretty significant number. They take tips on hundreds of offenses. At least some of the calls that they're getting in have to do with these immigration offenses that under previous administrations not considered priorities for action.
Like what?
Things like people calling in, reporting in an ex who might have overstayed a visa, or people calling in employers, people calling in either their own employer who might employ undocumented people as well, or just somebody that they're aware of.
Have you been able to find out whether these tips have led to investigations and actual arrests and deportations?
They do sometimes lead to further action. Basically, what happens when a call comes in is that the information is sent out to ICE field offices. It's less than half of the calls that come in typically that get referred to offices for further investigation. For instance, in 2017, out of those total calls, more than 165,000 calls, there were 131 arrests. It's a pretty small fraction of this that actually leads to action.
Some people are critical of this ICE call center. What are they upset about?
There are some concerns among civil liberties advocates about tip lines in general, and particularly with this one, sort of being an extension of law enforcement. It gives an opportunity to kind of deputize the public to enforce these laws. And one advocate that I spoke to in particular, he said that it's important to look at the activity of this tip line in the context of this current administration and the fact that there has been a big increase in attention on immigration issues under the Trump administration. And as you mentioned before, an expansion of the categories that are considered priorities for action.
Elizabeth Hewitt is a reporter for VT Digger. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much, Carol.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. President Trump has made cracking down on immigration a priority since he was sworn in, and his zero-tolerance policy and the family separations that followed have dominated the headlines lately. But this next story is about a lesser-known aspect of the U.S. government's immigration bureaucracy. It's called Operation Janus, and basically it's a government task force that reviews the cases of naturalized U.S. citizens to find out whether their applications contained false information. The task force dates back to the Obama administration, but it's been given more resources under President Trump. And that's raised concerns among immigration advocates and naturalized citizens. The World's Shirin Jafari has been looking into the story. Shirin, what have you found out?
Okay, Carol, let's go back to 2008 for a second. At that time, the government was still in full counterterrorism mode, right? And one employee at the U.S. Customs and Border Protection was doing some research on countries that were, quote, of interest to the U.S. And then he found that over the years, about 500 immigrants had managed to get citizenships or green cards, even though they had deportation orders, meaning that the court had told them they're not eligible to stay in the U.S. and that they have to leave the country.
But they got U.S. citizenship anyway? How did that happen?
So every time an immigrant applies for U.S. citizenship, they have to go through a background check. The USCIS, the government agency that's responsible for citizenship application, checks their fingerprints against at least two repositories, one at the FBI and the other at the Department of Homeland Security. New applicants have their fingerprints digitized, so it's quick and fairly easy to do this background check. But back in the early 1990s, for example, fingerprints were not digitized. They were taken down on paper. So it was more of an effort to do these background checks. That's why sometimes some flawed cases fell through the cracks. And for example, in one instance, someone used a different name to get citizenship, and the system wasn't set up to detect that.
So did that raise concern?
Yeah, and the Obama administration at that time realized that this is a problem. They set up a system to digitize fingerprints, and they started this task force to look into previous cases. And then we get to today, when the Trump administration just last month announced that they're putting more resources into this task force, and they're going to look into old cases to find out if any of them have any flaws in them. It's going to set up a new office in California, and it's hiring dozens of immigration lawyers to look into the records.
So have they found many cases of fraud so far?
No, not really. An official from the USCIS said that the agency has flagged 2,500 potential fraudulent cases, and 100 of those cases have been forwarded to the Department of Justice to start the denaturalization process, meaning revoking somebody's naturalization or citizenship.
You mentioned the denaturalization process. How easy is it for the government to revoke someone's citizenship?
When someone becomes a U.S. citizen, in the eyes of the law, they have the same rights as native-born citizens. So if the government thinks that it has a case against someone, it believes that somebody should lose their citizenship, then it has to file a court case against them. That person gets to fight the case in court, and it's important to point out that only a judge can order someone's citizenship removed. This is something that James Levine emphasized when I spoke with him last week. He is a lawyer and represents one of the two people who currently have cases pending in the courts. He said that when the government flags you as somebody who should lose their citizenship, that's not necessarily the end of your citizenship.
The government does not present your case when they make the claim. The government does not present your case when they file the lawsuit. You must present your own case.
He says you should get help from immigration lawyers, and if you can't afford the legal fees, then there are organizations that offer pro bono help.
How often does the U.S. government revoke someone's citizenship or denaturalize them?
I spoke with Amanda Frost about this. She teaches law at American University. She said that there was a period of time in the 1940s, 50s, and even early 60s when the government did revoke citizenship more often. This was part of the Cold War, the Red Scare. But later, the Supreme Court said, no, the government can't take away somebody's citizenship unless they renounce it themselves, or it's proven in court that the person obtained the citizenship through some kind of fraud.
After that case, which was decided in 1967, the government slowed down its denaturalization almost to a stop. I would say a few dozen cases a year at most, usually war criminals, serious criminals, or examples of fraud that were very serious and recent. So this is quite unusual.
So is the concern here that having President Trump reinvigorate this task force and give it more resources, that we're kind of going back to a time of when people were concerned about having their citizenship stripped away, often for political reasons?
Well, even the USCIS says that we are going to see a rise in the number of cases that are brought to court because they now have the resources and they have lawyers working on this. And This worries Amanda Frost, for example, the law professor.
There's a fear that if the government has a program that's up and running looking for people to denaturalize, one could fear that they would pursue people they didn't like. And that's not just paranoia that makes me say that. That is actually what the government did back in the 1940s and 50s. So there's some history of abuse of the denaturalization process that makes us concerned about its use today.
Just to be clear, Carol, since 2016, when all this started, just one person has lost their citizenship. And even that worries Frost. She also wonders if this is a good use of government time and resources, especially at a time when we already have such a big backlog in our immigration system.
Interesting story. The world's Shirin Jafari. Thanks for the update.
You're welcome, Carol.
I want to take a minute now to give you a little taste of a story you'll hear on tomorrow's show. We'll be sampling ice cream made in Philadelphia, sold around the U.S. and in East Asia. Customers like the taste.
The driver is the amount of butter fat in our product. We have a 16.5% butter fat recipe, which makes the product very rich and creamy. It has a very silky mouthfeel.
Bassett's ice cream is getting popular now in South Korea. It also has plenty of customers in China, where Bassett's is sold as a luxury brand.
And unlike a Ferrari or a Porsche, ice cream is affordable even to a middle-income customer, even if it's expensive by ice cream standards.
And according to this ice cream maker, company sales could be even sweeter.
No doubt about it. I am certain we will sell more ice cream without a tariff into China.
China, tariffs, and ice cream. That's coming up tomorrow on the show. I'm Carol Hills. British Prime Minister Theresa May is under pressure after two top ministers resigned over her Brexit plan. But she's hanging on to the job and a new nickname.
She's known as the zombie prime minister in Europe because she really has an impossible job. Whichever way she turns, she's going to be dealing with a difficult situation for Britain.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's been 2 months now since the U.S. moved its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. The move set off protests around the globe, but also prompted two other nations to follow suit. One of them was Guatemala, the other Paraguay. We wondered what prompted tiny majority Catholic Paraguay to make the move. The World's Rupa Shenoy was in the South American nation recently, and she reports that the answer has to do with Jews who fled Europe during World War II.
Jews called him the Angel of Death. He stood on a train platform at Auschwitz and decided that 400,000 people should die. Many of the ones he let live, he performed medical experiments on. Then, after World War II, Joseph Mengele moved to Paraguay. And one day in 1965, he walked into a jewelry store in the capital, Asunción.
Hasta donde sé, creo que fue la primera relojería que hubo en Paraguay.
I believe that was the first watch store in Paraguay, so lots of important people went there, ministers, ambassadors, because it was the only one.
Alexandra Tauber's driving out of Asunción, recounting her grandmother Sonia Tauber's story. She was the only one in the store when Mengele came in.
She knew his face, but she didn't know from where.
Mengele asked to see a watch. Her grandmother reached for it. Her sleeve went up, and Mengele saw Tauber's grandmother's tattoo, the numbers they put on her at Auschwitz. His face changed. Then she knew where she'd seen him before.
She recognized him and screamed, "Mengele, Mengele!" And my grandfather came to see why she was screaming.
Mengele turned and ran out, and that's where the family story ends. It took international pressure to get Paraguayan dictator Alfredo Stroessner to cancel Mengele's citizenship in 1979. There were rumors he was still there for years afterward. After World War II, about 1,000 Jewish families from Europe made lives for themselves in Paraguay. Tauber says her grandparents ended up here after they couldn't get citizenship in Brazil and Argentina. The Jewish community in Asunción was close-knit, and their children married inside that tight circle. Tauber remembers her grandmother used to ask her why she had non-Jewish friends. She told Tauber they wouldn't be there when it counts.
Trauma, esa miedo, esa persecución en su cabeza, ¿verdad?
So that's why I think she had trauma and persecution in her head. The first generation that was born here in Paraguay suffered a lot because they weren't able to mix with people of other religions.
Still, those Jewish immigrants and their children flourished. They became a prominent minority group and some of the most important business people in the capital. And like a lot of Jews everywhere after World War II, they kept a focus on Israel.
When I was a girl, I remember my grandfather would buy trees in Israel and send money to Israel. They always helped. And in fact, Jews in Paraguay have a strong influence in the relationship with Israel because, well, there's a legend. Some people say it's true and some people say it's a lie. What they say is...
The story is that a famous Jewish doctor, a relative of one of Tauber's friends, lobbied the Paraguayan government to vote in the UN in 1947 to partition Palestine, a move that led to the creation of Israel. Many times since, Israel has helped Paraguay with aid and assistance for its agriculture industry. Now Paraguay is one of the biggest exporters of kosher meat to Israel. Tauber says all of that was helped along by Jewish Paraguayans.
Y la influencia también se ve ahora que Paraguay es la tercera embajada que muda su embajada de Tel Aviv a Jerusalén.
And you can see the influence now again with Paraguay being the third to move its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That certainly didn't happen without their influence.
A great day for Israel, a great day for Paraguay, a great day for our friendship.
In May, at the dedication of the new Paraguayan embassy in Jerusalem, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hailed Paraguayan President Horacio Cartes, who incidentally has been investigated by the U.S. for drug trafficking and money laundering.
Paraguay helped Jews escape Nazi Germany. We will never forget this. You did this before the Holocaust, during the Holocaust, and after the Holocaust.
Netanyahu didn't mention that Paraguay also harbored Nazis like Mengele.
Thank you, Horacio. Thank you. And thank you, Paraguay.
The embassy move was controversial in Paraguay. President Cartes was on his way out, and his successor, Mario Abdo Benitez, had already been elected. Benitez said he didn't know or agree with the decision. For the older members of the Jewish community in Paraguay, though, it was a culmination of everything Tauber's grandmother's generation had worked for. But their descendants in Paraguay are much more attached to the country where they grew up. Tauber lived in Los Angeles for a while before she decided to come back. She worked for a long time in a big women's prison in Asunción. Now she acts as a middleman, trying to connect stores with low-income artisans in the countryside. Today she's visiting a weaver named Nyakata, a grandmother who still supports her grown children and cares for her 90-something father. Kata's fingers are constantly moving, weaving. She never stops. Tauber and Kata debate the design of a straw hat and agree to try something new.
No, hacer, pero no unir. Hacer hasta acá y hasta acá.
Se corta solamente.
Later, Kata tells me she didn't know any Jews before she met Tauber, and she doesn't know any other Jews now. But Tauber seems nice. Driving back to Asunción, Tauber reflects that she's still something of an outsider.
En el sentido de que, o sea, con la gente más de pueblo, más, digamos, un poco más ignorante...
There's a lot of urban legends about Jews, especially among people in the countryside, that we supposedly killed Jesus, that Jews are monsters. Sometimes when people realize I'm Jewish, they can't believe it.
Despite that, Tauber still feels like Paraguay is her home. For the world, Rupa Shenoy, Asunción.
It's been 2 years since the people of Britain voted narrowly to leave the European Union, but the government is no closer to figuring out how this is actually going to happen. In fact, the cabinet has not even been able to agree on a plan. Two top ministers resigned this week in protest at Prime Minister Theresa May's latest proposal that's thrown her leadership into question. Ryan Heath is political editor for Politico Europe. He's based in Brussels. Ryan, Brexit is scheduled for March 29th next year. As of right now, what will happen on that day?
We don't have a plan, is the honest answer, Carol. The UK has used up almost 18 months of its two-year negotiating period, and it hasn't decided exactly what it's negotiating for yet. Now, last Friday, the British government, the cabinet, did come up with a plan, but that was before the people who were in charge of implementing the plan decided to resign. So we're not exactly sure where we stand. What the people in Brussels at the European Union are looking for is for the UK to have any kind of position. They've got red lines of their own in the negotiation, but they're just looking for somebody who is willing to turn up at the table and actually get into the serious bargaining.
What's at issue? I mean, Theresa May has put forward a proposal. What does she want?
She wants to have a transition out of the EU that minimizes disruption to the British economy. She's also got some very serious peace commitments to live up to in Ireland, where there is a division between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And that was resolved, or at least turned into a stalemate, in the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. And so she's very reluctant to upset the peace that has been there for the last 20 years. And what we're dealing with now is a very different world to the one where the UK entered the European Union. Now we have much more complex global supply chains. We have millions of Britons living in other European countries, millions of Europeans living in the UK. So there's an awful lot at stake. And what Theresa May has tried to do is buy some time in this process of leaving the EU so that it's not a cliff edge in 2019. And she's got about two more years of transition. But to many people who campaign to leave the EU, that doesn't count. That isn't the flag-waving, huge leap of freedom that they were looking for. So they are trying to push her into a much tougher jump outside of the EU.
Now, let's talk about the two members of her cabinet who resigned in protest, including her very colorful Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. Obviously, they're resigning because they don't like her plan. What would they prefer?
They are very much on the campaigning side, the hard Brexiteers as we know them in Europe. And what they want is for the UK to have total freedom, the freedom to strike their own trade deals, the freedom to reject European Union regulations, and the freedom to really own this idea of Britishness again. Now, the people on the other side of the table say that you can be British and European at the same time, and that these people are being too extreme in their interpretations, and that they ignore the fact that when the UK gains freedom by getting itself out of that EU negotiating room, it also loses the heft of being in a 500 million strong single market. So that's where the tension is, really. The David Davises and the Boris Johnsons of the world, they do not want to feel like a colony. They do not want to feel dictated to by the European Union. And in order to make sure they avoid that fate, they want to cut all of the ties as quickly and cleanly as possible.
Is the to-ing and fro-ing between the hotshot politicians, is that reflected in the British population? I mean, how does it translate into real sort of feelings by Brits themselves?
I think there are hardcore bases on both sides of the argument, but what you have is a majority who's simply tired of all of the arguing, where you've had a political debate in Britain for 2.5 years now that has just simply been dominated by this issue of the European Union. So if you want to have a discussion about where the school system or the education system and the health system should be going, you don't really have the space to make those arguments in British political debate at the moment. It almost entirely revolves around this Brexit discussion.
Can Theresa May survive as Prime Minister?
She can, and that might seem surprising given all the drama we've just spoken about. But she's known as the zombie prime minister in Europe because she really has an impossible job. Whichever way she turns, she's going to be dealing with a difficult situation for Britain. The bad days will come before the good days of Brexit, let's put it that way. And nobody wants to take that job from her.
Ryan Heath is with Politico Europe. He's based in Brussels. Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Thank you.
Finally, they're all out. All 12 members of the Wild Boars soccer team and their coach have been rescued now after spending 2 weeks trapped in a flooded cave complex in northern Thailand. It's a great relief, of course, though it follows the tragic death of one of the rescuers. And for the rescued kids, it wasn't immediate hugs and kisses with mom and dad. They've been quarantined at a hospital and have only been able to see their parents through glass partitions. So there are clearly ongoing medical concerns for the team. We talked to Alex Rowe about that. He's with World Extreme Medicine, a group that trains doctors to work under extreme conditions. I asked him why the boys are in quarantine now.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking quite hard about the quarantine this week. And actually, the main illnesses that these kids are likely to have picked up down in the cave are either leptospirosis or histoplasmosis. And histoplasmosis is a fungal spore that gets transmitted by bats and their droppings. And you tend to pick it up in caves from the dust and the mud in there. So I suspect that it's going to be the histoplasmosis that they're worried about. And from what I see on the news feeds today, there has been at least one child, I think there were two, with possible lung symptoms at the moment. So it could be that that's histoplasmosis. The reassuring thing is that most cases of histoplasmosis actually get better on their own and they don't need any treatment with antifungal medication. So I suspect they'll just be keeping an eye on them. But having had discussions with other groups, we're not quite sure of the relevance of the quarantine. And I suspect it's the Thai authorities just being super careful in the face of international media.
The kids and their coach are also required to wear sunglasses and eat specific food. What's that about?
So the kids, when they come out, they're wearing sunglasses because when you spend a long period of time in pitch black, even with a small amount of light every now and again, the pupil in the eye, the bit that lets the light in, is actually getting less and less reactive to light. So normally when we stare at a bright light, our pupil, like the hole in the eye, just constricts and it lets less light in. The problem with being in extreme dark is that your eye stops doing that. So certainly for the first few days, it won't react to that bright light. So it could cause damage, but also it would cause pain and a lot of discomfort. So the glasses are mainly for protection of the eyes until the eyes get back to normal, and they will get back to normal over the next few days.
What about the specific food that they're being given?
So the food they're being given will need to be calculated based on their calorie need every day. So the risk is when people have been starved for an amount of time, they can't be refed straight away. You can't just go back onto the normal diet that you're on before and the same amount of it. And the reason for that is that you can get imbalances of salt in the blood and also vitamins. So there is a risk that if you start putting in quite high carbohydrate or quite sugary things, which people assume are good because it's energy, you can get deficiencies in vitamins. And the main vitamin you might get a deficiency in is thiamine, which is a vitamin which we get in our diet usually. And if you get a deficiency in it, you can actually get deterioration in the brain and cognitive function. So we've got to be careful not to have that crisis where the thiamine levels drop so low that they can get complications from that.
Dr. Alex Rowe is with World Extreme Medicine. Thanks for speaking with us.
That's a pleasure.
Millions of people have fled the war in Syria since the conflict started in 2011. Many are stuck living as refugees in neighboring countries. Others have tried making their way west to apply for asylum. But for the Syrian refugee we're about to hear from, the path led east to Kuala Lumpur International Airport in Malaysia. Hassan Al-Kontar has been stuck there for more than 120 days. He spoke recently to our colleagues at the BBC about his situation.
I spend my day reading and on the net, my only access to the world. Asia Air gives me 3 meals a day, which is what I'm currently surviving on. My problem started back in 2011 when I was working and living in United Arab Emirates. The Syrian war started. I refused to join the fight because I don't believe in war. So I become wanted to the Syrian government. The Emirati authorities wanted to deport me to Syria, but after protesting and insisting to be sent anywhere else, I was sent to Malaysia. After 3 months of staying in Malaysia, which is the maximum amount of time I can stay in the country, I had to find another solution. I tried some countries who is allowing Syrians with no visa, no need to visa, like Cambodia. They sent me back. I get a ticket to Ecuador. They also don't require a visa from us as Syrians. But the Turkey airline in Malaysia airport decided not to board me. So I lost all my money. And as you can see, I'm in an airport, stuck here actually. They are not allowing me to enter.
That's why Hassan Al-Kontar started a social media campaign. He figured the attention could only help his case. And he's trying to stay positive about it all.
Generally, I'm an optimistic person, which has helped me fight depression. At first, I was angry at everyone until I realized those countries are not rejecting me for personal reasons. They are rejecting me because I am a Syrian. I am a part of the Syrian refugee tragedy. started in 2011.
Hassan's story seems to have had an impact in Canada, at least. A group of people there is circulating a petition asking the Canadian government to let him in. It has thousands of signatures. Hassan himself says what he wants is pretty basic.
Dignity, human rights, love, peace, place to work, be legal, is all what I'm asking for.
Hassan Al-Kontar speaking there to our partners at the BBC from the airport at Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, where he's been stuck for about 4 months now. Finally today, I like quesadillas, those warm tortillas filled with gooey melted cheese. They're kind of a quintessential Mexican food for many Americans, but what if I told you that millions of Mexicans prefer their quesadillas without cheese, and that the dish might not even be all that Mexican? Here's Maya Croth from Mexico City.
When I moved to Mexico City 5 years ago, people gave me the same two or three pieces of advice. Watch your purse on the metro, have a taxi company on speed dial, and if you want cheese on your quesadilla, you better ask for it. This last one I didn't get. What do you mean a quesadilla doesn't always come with cheese? What else is a quesadilla, if not a tortilla plus cheese?
It happened to me once. I asked for a quesadilla with chicken, and then when I opened it, I was like, what is the cheese? I was like, oh, you need to ask quesadilla with cheese.
I met Rael at a quesadilla stand in the Coyoacan neighborhood. When he first moved to Mexico City from the northern state of Sonora, he was just as confused as I was.
In other parts of Mexico, we just laugh about this, and it's just like, it doesn't make any sense for us. But, yeah.
But to millions in Mexico City, a quesadilla without cheese makes perfect sense. As cook Marta Martinez explains, her customers like their quesadillas filled with all kinds of stuff. Squash blossoms, mushrooms, sliced peppers. Cheese is often an afterthought.
Bueno, ya, ya es el gusto de la persona, ¿verdad? De cada quien. Aquí es normal sin queso.
Customers have their own preferences, she says, but here it's totally normal to order a quesadilla without cheese. A few years back, a meme circulated online that attempted to justify this cheeseless quesadilla thing with an etymology lesson. The meme argued that quesadilla doesn't come from the Latin word for cheese. It's from the indigenous Nahuatl word quesaditzin, meaning folded tortilla.
Porque eso sí debería ser una absoluta tontería, una barbaridad.
Total nonsense. That word cannot be Nahuatl for so many reasons.
That's Alberto Peralta, an anthropologist and culinary historian at Mexico City's Anahuac University. He speaks enough Nahuatl to know that this theory, no way.
Los aztecas y la gente prehispánica no usaba la tortilla como la usamos ahora. No hay ni una sola.
The Aztecs didn't use tortillas like we use them now. There's no mention in any of the historical chronicles that say the Mexicans took their tortillas and filled them with stuff and folded them up and put them into their mouth. None.
He says that when the conquistadors arrived from Spain, tortillas were used more like a utensil than a food. But Peralta got so interested in the debate that he went to the oldest sources he could think of in search of the quesadilla's origins. And he thinks he found them. In a 16th century Italian cookbook. The recipe described a dish that sounds kind of like a fried Pop-Tart.
Y todo parece corresponder con estas empanadas medievales pequeñas.
It all seems to come back to these small medieval empanadas that were fried, sweetened, and eaten as portable food. They may or may not have had cheese in the middle, but there was cheese in the dough.
Peralta thinks these empanadas crossed the Atlantic with the Europeans. In the absence of wheat, native corn masa was substituted for bread dough. In fact, what Mexico City calls a quesadilla is still called empanada in Veracruz. Over time, the snack took on regional variations. In the north, where farmers grow wheat and raise cattle, you're more likely to find a quesadilla made from flour tortilla filled with melty cheese. But in Mexico City,
nosotros no tenemos vaquitas ni cosas así, pero tenemos una central.
We don't have cows, but we do have a central market that is the largest in Latin America. I have everything I want at my fingertips. We're like Rome. What do you want to buy? You can get it here.
Mexico City was at the crossroads of centuries-old trade routes running up and down the Americas, Peralta says. All that diversity made the menu more complex, so cheese became just another ingredient. So who's right? The pro-cheese people from outside the capital or the city folk?
Yo diría que no tiene nadie la razón. El mismo símbolo.
I say that nobody's right. It's just the same symbol with two different interpretations in two different places.
In the Mexican quesadilla wars, the two sides may have to agree to disagree. For The World, Maya Croth, Mexico City.
That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.